Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You're going to think I'm making this up. You really are. But this was basically the monetary policy advice the President of the United States gave to the Chairman of the Federal Reserve this very morning.
Stop thinking. Let things happen. And be the ball.
Caddyshack or real life? You decide. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 18th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been too long, don't you think, since we started the program with a presidential tweet? Lucky for us, then, that the president obliged this morning with the Federal Reserve meeting today and tomorrow on interest rates. Mr. Trump let this loose at 7:13 this morning, Washington time. Quote, feel the market. Don't just go by meaningless numbers. Good luck. That's the end of the quote. And with that as prologue, see the ball. And with some market discontent of late, we are going to turn now to Gina Smiley. She covers the economy from Bloomberg, also shows up here on Fridays every now and then. Hey, Gina.
Hey, hi. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm loving life with the Caddyshack tweet. What can I tell you? So look, can we talk first of all for a second about the volatility in the markets the last, number of weeks and months? What's driving that?
Yeah, I think that is the million-dollar question right now. I mean, so we really, I think the context that's important for thinking about this is we're coming off of not just a very calm year in 2017, but a very calm 6 years, really, since the crisis before that. And so I think what we've been seeing recently is really surprising a lot of people, and we don't have good answers as to what is driving it. You know, you see big market moves on trade announcements, on anything related to sort of government shutdown, and currently very much on anything Fed-related at all. And so it seems like it's just this sort of confluence of factors, a lot of uncertainty that's really keeping people on the edges of their seats.
Do you think part of the volatility, certainly leading up to tomorrow's announcement by the Fed, is uncertainty about what they're going to do sort of the cause of the uncertainty, or is there an effect issue here with the Fed now looking at the markets going, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, it does seem like we may have some sort of a feedback loop. But
right,
as someone who covers the Fed sort of day in, day out, I can say that they generally don't take a lot of signal from near-term market moves. Now, extended volatility that bleeds through to the real economy is something that they definitely worry about. It's not that they don't care about markets, but they, I don't think, are going to make decisions based on any short-term moves.
Key point there, short-term volatility not bleeding through to the real economy, right? That's a key factor here.
Exactly. Right. That's really the distinction. It's not that they're ignoring it. It's that what they care about at the end of the day is real economic growth.
Gotcha. To the president's tweet this morning and a couple of tweets in the last couple of days, he's leaning on the Fed. That's not unusual. The way he's doing it is sort of unusual. But let me ask you this. Is it possible that the president is right, that perhaps what is needed now from the Fed is maybe not a rate increase with some signs that there may be some slowing in this economy? Maybe the Fed ought to take a pause.
I think plenty of people would agree with that assessment. Yeah. You know, a lot of the data is coming in a way that points to a Fed pause being a good idea. At the end of the day, though, you know, the Fed is going to have to make that decision. They very much signaled a hike this month.
Yep.
And so it would be a surprise if they didn't make it.
Also, in light of the president leaning on them, it would be tough for them to back off now, right? Just real
absolutely.
Quick.
It would open some questions up,
right,
I think.
Right. Gina Smiley covers the economy for Bloomberg. Gina, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, take it easy. All right, as I said, there is something of an economic conundrum going on right now, which is complicating the whole conversation about the Fed and what it might or might not do tomorrow. There is plenty of data that shows the economy is doing pretty well right now. Job growth, consumer spending, to name just a couple. But there is stuff to worry about as well. A New York Times survey of CEOs not too long ago found half of them thought we could hit a recession by the end of next year. Now, maybe we will and maybe we won't, but can we talk ourselves into a recession? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
There's a story that Keith Crane, editor-in-chief of Automotive News, likes to tell. It's about a son who comes back from college, and he tells his dad, who's a car dealer,
"Dad, we're going to get a recession. You better cut back on your advertising. Instead of being open 8 hours, we better go to 6.
Sure enough, business tanks. Because by doing all of those things, the car dealer made it tank.
And the father said, "Boy, is my son smart."
It was, as they say, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Oh, I have seen this happen over 40 years in business quite often.
Many economists believe this story can play out on a macro scale. George Lowenstein is director of behavioral economics at the Center for Health Incentives at the University of Pennsylvania.
People talk to one another, and that creates a kind of an echo effect.
There are a lot of feedback loops in economics like this, and it's not just consumers maybe getting worried and holding off on buying a new car. Businesses do the same thing. Scott Brown is chief economist at Raymond James.
Firms have to think about the future and deciding when to invest in new plant and equipment, whether to hire and train new workers. And if they expect a recession, they're less likely to do so.
All that said, feelings in economics, as in real life, can be fickle. Noah Smith is an economist and writer at Bloomberg Opinion.
People are predicting recession. Those predictions could reverse tomorrow.
What makes this so tricky, though, is that while people can be irrational, they also really can sometimes sense when something bad's coming. As FDR said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, but also maybe a recession. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
But also maybe a recession. You are probably most familiar with the Great Recession, but America has been through dozens of economic downturns. You can read about those and get a little context of what happened and why at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, touched on that a little bit with Gina. My favorite five-syllable word was on display again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just when you thought you could make it through a whole day without hearing about Google expanding in New York or Apple expanding in Austin, Texas, or how New York and Northern Virginia gave away the economic store to get Amazon and the respective halves of HQ2. Oh, well, wait, no, we are actually going to talk about HQ2, but we're going to do the flip side of that story because these are not one-way deals, you know, and the winners, if that's the right word, had some demands of their own. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Crystal City in Northern Virginia.
There are a few things that make Crystal City, well, unusual. For one, its name can be traced back to a giant chandelier. The neighborhood sits on top of a network of tunnels, and a handful of its office buildings are wrapped in giant artworks.
So the building that you're looking at right there is 1801 South Bell.
That's Brian Cotter with local real estate developer JBG Smith. And the story of what's actually 1851 South Bell and its colorful abstract exterior is also the story of Crystal City and part of what brings us to this. The 25-page agreement between Amazon and Virginia for HQ2. Economist Jeanette Chapman flips through the pages. All the basics are there. Tax breaks and grants for Amazon, jobs and promises of development for Northern Virginia. And at the bottom of page 5,
buried in the technical details,
is what you could call an insurance policy for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Chapman even has it marked with yellow highlighter.
If more than 10% of the new jobs at the facility are primarily engaged in supporting federal government contracts, the percentage over 10% will be.
In other words, Virginia doesn't want too many of Amazon's new employees tied to work for the federal government. Chapman says the clause may not mean much to Amazon, but it says a lot about what matters to the local economy.
The Commonwealth has very wisely said, well, we already have a lot of that, and we're not going to incentivize that.
Because for a long time, Crystal City was basically dependent on one employer, namely the federal government, especially the Department of Defense.
It was a place where other DOD workers and contracts associated with the DOD could go and have office space that wasn't quite as expensive as downtown D.C.
But was still just across the river from Capitol Hill and just across the road from the Pentagon. That's what attracted Marine veteran Isaac Barnes when he was starting his tech business, Eminent IT.
I thought for our business being DOD focused, this would be one of the best places for us to be. right? Just so when we travel, we have a short commute, not even a block. It's crossing the street, one light.
But what the government giveth, the government can take away. And over the last decade, Congress pushed round after round of spending cuts, and Defense Department offices and staff were relocated all over the country. Again, economist Jeanette Chapman.
That moved about 17,000 DOD workers outside of Crystal City. And along with that went probably about 10,000 contractors.
Whole buildings emptied out. Small businesses suffered. Isaac Barnes lived through the exodus. In 2011, the government was leasing nearly half the office space in the area. Now, it's less than a third.
It was scary for a lot of people. A lot of people thought Crystal City would become a ghost town.
But it didn't. As the defense workers left, the community focused on diversifying the local economy. Walk around Crystal City today, which, by the way, is being rebranded as National Landing. There are still plenty of people in military uniforms, but also workers heading into nonprofits, media companies, restaurants, which brings us back to that building dressed up like an abstract painting and JBG's Brian Cotter.
The wrapped buildings are all out of service, former office buildings.
Out of service, as in 12 stories or more, completely empty. Cotter says with Amazon coming to town, those buildings will be unwrapped and updated. But for now, they stand as colorful reminders of what Crystal City / National Landing is determined to keep from happening again. In Arlington, Virginia, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The next iteration of the internet is upon us this week. AT&T is going to roll out something called 5G technology in about a dozen cities. It's kind of a big beta test, so don't get your hopes up too high. But while the 3 and 4G upgrades were mostly about our phones, 5G, once it's fully up and running, is going to be about everything else. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
5G is designed to be faster and to connect more devices at once. Tim Dettinger, professor at Carnegie Mellon University, says it may spur new ways of communicating from person to person and
from device to device to car to person, etc.
AT&T is particularly interested in that device-to-device market, says Gordon Mansfield, an AT&T VP. He says the company has chosen to start with cities where it has a strong client base. Phase two will follow specific industries, healthcare or manufacturing.
And so we can go into those facilities and build special purpose infrastructure to provide the coverage to their facility to work with them and partner on learning what the capabilities enable for them.
But Philip Berenbroek with think tank Public Knowledge says that strategy of going to places that already have established infrastructure could widen the digital divide.
If you're in a place that's rural or a place that doesn't already have high-speed fixed broadband, it's unlikely that you're going to see 5G soon.
And having this much connectivity opens up new ways that hackers could threaten day-to-day life, says cybersecurity expert Sam Sachs with the think tank New America.
It's going to require a whole host of measures to make sure that even as we get super fast, more connected devices, are we also going to get security at the same time?
There may not be much time to figure that out. Verizon and T-Mobile are also working on their 5G networks. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in telecommunications, coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, a preview of BlackBerry's earnings. They are out Thursday. Also, BlackBerry is still in business, just not really so much with BlackBerries. There is news today from Hawthorne, California. The Wall Street Journal reports that Elon Musk's rocket company SpaceX is raising capital to launch its long-awaited satellite internet system. $500 million is the raise, says the Journal, values the company at a hair more than 30 billion simoleons all in. Rockets are big, expensive projects, as you know, so we figured we would re-up a slice of my interview with SpaceX COO Gwen Shotwell from last week that we couldn't squeeze in at the time on that day. I was asking her about when or if the company might go public. Here's what she said.
Yeah, so capital markets don't respond well to plowing your entire revenue stream back into your technology.
Right.
So I think as long as we want to spend all the money we earn on making our technology better and pushing it further, I think we'll stay private.
There you
go. I think Elon has said, believes that when we are taking people regularly back and forth to Mars, that would be the time to go public, if then.
And if you remember from the original conversation back and forth to Mars, she said about 10 years. So there you go. Space and rocket aficionados among you. Also, those who just enjoy an interesting interview can hear my whole conversation with Gwen Shotwell from the rocket factory that she runs on our Corner Office podcast. Check it out. Coming up.
But when you get them in the house, they're not as small as they look.
True in life, true in Christmas trees. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 82 points today, 0.3%, 23,675. The NASDAQ up 30 points, 0.4%, ended things at 6783. The S&P 500 flat, finished at 25.46. The Dow at one point, the blue chips up something like 340 points early in the day. Oracle improved 0.2% today. The software company predicted better than expected current quarter profits, citing growth in its cloud services. That's where all the money is. Rival Microsoft firmed up 1%. Salesforce up about 0.1%. Plane maker Boeing ascended 3.7% today. The company increased its stock buyback program and raised its dividend by 22.0%. Falling oil prices hit energy stocks. ExxonMobil down 2.7%. Occidental Petroleum gave back about 1.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. We do more than the numbers here at Marketplace. You know, we tell the stories behind the numbers, stories of real people, of businesses, both big and small, and of the impact the economy has on each of us. Because you appreciate this kind of public service journalism, we're asking you to give something back. Please donate today at Marketplace.org, and your gift will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The Attorney General of the great state of New York, Barbara Underwood, announced a settlement with President Trump this morning concerning the foundation that bears his name. It's going to shut down, is the short version, amid an ongoing lawsuit and investigation. David Farenthold covers the Trump family and its businesses for The Washington Post. He has been following this court case and where the president's money has been going since the very beginning. David, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
The Attorney General, Ms. Underwood, pulled no punches today. Persistently illegal conduct is the allegation in this lawsuit. What did she say that the Trump Foundation did that was so wrong?
Well, a number of things. The three main things are, number one, Trump used the foundation as sort of a checkbook for his businesses. So when his businesses had to pay off legal settlements, Trump used his charity's money instead. Number two, Trump used the money from his charity to buy things for himself, notably a $10,000 portrait of himself that he then hung up on the wall in one of his golf clubs. And number three, Trump, she's accused of turning his charity into basically an arm of his campaign in 2016, sort of using it as a prop and as a way of funding giveaways to veterans groups that he made on stage at political rallies in Iowa and New Hampshire.
The president says he is a billionaire. This foundation, though, was teeny tiny.
It's really surprising. For someone of his claimed wealth, it was extremely small. And more surprising than that, even when it had money, generally it was not Trump's money. People assume when they got a check from the Donald J. Trump Foundation, well, this must be Trump's money originally. But since 2007, almost all of the money in the Trump Foundation came from somebody else, notably Vince and Linda McMahon, the pro wrestling moguls. They gave Trump's foundation $5 million in 2007 and 2009. And for years, he just gave their money away.
What are the next steps that happen with the foundation? I mean, obviously, the judge is going to supervise the distribution of assets.
That's right. They're going to sell off the remaining physical assets of the foundation, which are a couple of portraits of Trump and a Tim Tebow helmet that Trump bought with charity money. And then also the lawsuit will continue. So he still faces those monetary penalties and the possibility of a ban from charity service.
Anybody who follows you on Twitter knows the saga of that portrait that he spent and that you have been searching for. Did you ever find that portrait?
Amazingly enough, there are two portraits that Trump bought with charity money. One of them I found with the help of some Twitter followers. We found it hanging on the wall of Trump's golf resort at Doral outside Miami. The other one, which he bought for $20,000 of charity money, I've never found. I don't know where it is. I've tried doing a Google reverse image search, putting this picture of him into Google image search to see if it turns up anywhere else. And Google has told me it thinks that that's an orange.
No, you're making that up.
No, it's like we have lots of pictures of oranges here. So that was no help.
Man. Also, just the kicker to your story on this whole thing this morning, the Trump Foundation now values that portrait at $0. Is that right?
At $0, which may mean they've lost it, which would really break my heart. But yeah, they value it at $0, down from $700.
David Farenthold covers the president, his businesses, and also his foundation for the Washington Post. David, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Six shopping days till Christmas, gang, so you had best get a move on. And should you still be in the market for a tree, a real one, of course, come on, get ready to pay a little bit more this year than last, $68, about a 7% bump from 2017. But with some timing and some market research, you can still get a deal. From the Marketplace Hub at WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, Ohio, Adrian Ma goes tree shopping.
In a big parking lot just off the freeway, Kim Londrico is leading me through rows and rows of trees.
The nicest of the trees is the Fraser fir.
Okay.
There are also other firs. There's Douglas fir, concolor fir, Canaan fir.
She's owner of Londrico's Christmas Trees, a wholesale and retail operation. And she's been in the business over 3 decades, so she is pretty good at selling trees.
When you're outside, these trees look small. But when you get them in the house, they're not as small as they look.
But I'm here to get a deal. So before I came, I consulted some experts, like Sarah Vera.
I love Christmas trees.
She's a data scientist at Square, and she's analyzed sales from over 1,000 tree merchants from around the country. Vera says if you want a bargain, first consider your timing.
We see every single year, very predictably, the first weekend in December is the blockbuster weekend to buy a Christmas tree.
Prices peak just after Thanksgiving and drop the closer you get to the 25th. So the longer you wait, the more you save. But be careful. Wait too long and your choices will be limited.
Correct. So you might end up with a Charlie Brown Christmas tree.
Okay, don't buy too early or too late. Check. Now, there are websites that'll sell you a tree online, but then you couldn't use money-saving tip number 2. Negotiate. John Paul Stevens teaches negotiation at Case Western Reserve University. He says the important thing is to go in knowing exactly what you want.
You know, the height of the tree, the width of the tree, how scraggly it is versus how full it is.
No problem. Back at Londrico's.
What I want, I think what I want is like something that's about 6 or 7 feet. Okay. I hear Fraser firs are kind of the hot thing this year.
Fraser firs, the Lincoln of the trees.
The Lincoln
of the trees, the nicest of the trees.
You think of it as a conversation that you're about to have, and it's like, I'm just here to learn about what's important to you.
In other words, Steven says, try to think of negotiating as a collaboration, not a competition.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Is there any flexibility on the price?
Yes.
How does 20 sound?
For a $29 tree?
Yeah.
No. I wouldn't do 20. I would do 28.
I don't know. I feel like 28.
We go back and forth a bit until...
Why don't we meet in the middle and go 25?
25?
Okay.
All right. So I saved myself $4. And that's in a year when it's kind of a seller's market. Londrico figures she's going to sell out about 8,000 trees, even though she's raised prices about 25% this year. Supply is tight. And she's noticed less competition.
That's why all these little people that are normally on the corners aren't on the corners this year because they couldn't get any trees.
But one person's shortage is another's opportunity. Tim O'Connor is with the National Christmas Tree Association. He says growers have been waiting for over a decade for a market like this.
If you go back to the late 90s and the early 2000s, growers had produced way too many Christmas trees.
That oversupply, along with the Great Recession, took a huge toll on growers. But now the economy's up and growers are finally reaping a profit from folks like me.
And then one of the guys will take it to your car, load it up for you.
I got my tree. Maybe it's not the deal of the century, but at least I got to see the merchandise in person. I even got to smell it. Try doing that online. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, government shutdown edition. First of all, we are not going to have one. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said this to Casey Hunt of NBC News today when he was asked if he was sure there wasn't going to be a Christmas shutdown. Quote, yeah, I'm sure. So there's that. Also, on the off chance that McConnell is wrong, for all you kids out there, yes, even if there is a shutdown, NORAD, that would be the North American Aerospace Defense Command, of course. NORAD is still going to track Santa Claus on Christmas Eve. We are on duty 24/7, 365 days a year. That's according to a NORAD spokesman. All right, we're going. The Dow up 0.3% today. The NASDAQ gained 0.4%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Everything was up a lot earlier in the day, though. Volatility, my favorite five-syllable word. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.